So I will give a talk on the rheology of worm-like micelles, and I will. This is a work that has been done at the University of Montpellier. Most of the work was made with Grégoire Porte during the PhD thesis of Denis Roux, and during the last years, I've worked intensively with Sandra Lerouge and Jean-Paul De Krupp from the University of Metz. And during all these years, we benefited from the support from the neutron facility in France, in Grenoble, Institut Lao et Langevin, and Laboratoire Léon Brillouin, with Peter Liner and Laurence Noirez. I will speak about worm-like micelles. My point is not to give an overview. My point is not to give a review of the whole results, because there is a tremendous amount of data, and it's, as you will see, sometimes difficult to find a unique behavior. My point will be to try to give you what I think is the most common behavior in these worm-like micelles, in terms of nonlinear rheology, of course. So you all know that worm-like micelles are long polymer-like chains, and they result from the association of this small surfactant into these large worms. Just remember that these worms have a diameter of about twice this length, so something like 40 angstrom, which is a usual value. And something which is also remarkable in that I should mention is that usual surfactants, usual worm-like micelles, are made with C16 surfactants. You need something to put with. But C16 surfactants, you cannot make worm-like micelles easily with C14, and C18 is not soluble. So this is just C16 surfactants which are concerned. There exist some rheology-like micelles with C12 or C14. But the main amount of rheology data are on this system. When I started soft condensed matter, I started with the rheology of worm-like micelles some years ago in the lab of Grégoire Porte, and I was introduced to worm-like micelles in the following way. In physical chemistry, you have phase behavior where you mixed surfactant, co-surfactant, and water. In one of the region of this phase diagram, which is called a ternary phase diagram, which has the form of a triangle, you have the self-assembled structure of interest where we are working with. And these self-assembled structure are spherical micelles, elongated micelles, or layers. Grégoire has the way to plot it in, more simply, where you put here the co-surfactant concentration and here the surfactant concentration. And I was convinced that for system of surfactants, when you increase the co-surfactant concentration, you just reduce the curvature of the surfactant film. So the more you put of these small molecules, the more you decurve or you reduce the curvature, and so you go from spheres to cylinders. You have a biphasic, then the lamellar phase, and then the L3 phase. In the same spirit, it is in the same spirit that the growth of cylindrical micelles is considered in the Israelashvili's paper in 76 and in other papers. The main mechanism for the driving growth of the micelles, it was what is called the NCAP energy, which is related to this curvature of the surfactant film. The curvature of the surfactant film is different here as in the NCAP, and the difference is an important parameter. And it is made in this paper, or it is calculated, that the number density of micelles of aggregation number n, so which is given aggregation number, is exponential. You can see the concentration. This is the amount of surfactant you put in your solution, or in your theoretical solution, so to speak. And you have also the average aggregation number n bar, which is going like square root of the concentration of surfactant and some exponential of the NCAP energy. So this means, according to these predictions, which are well accepted and well known, that micelles are broadly distributed. And if you need a number to relate the aggregation number and the length of this object, you can say this number is 200 molecules are making 100 angstrom in length of the object, okay, if you want to replace it in the experimental context. In addition to that, there is this mechanism. These objects are equilibrium, a structure, and so they have the possibility to break and recombine. And the probability of breakage has to be assumed in the model by Cates to be proportional to the length. The longer the micelle, the easier it will break. So why I am speaking about all that? I am speaking about all that because I want to mention one point about the physical chemistry of the worm-like micelles. And this is the point I want to develop in the next transparencies. If you are doing experiments, what are you doing exactly? So the main method, which is never used, is to add coarse surfactant to a surfactant solution. And it is very there are very few papers reporting on micelles, except the one by Port and co-authors. You can add salt and other. I mean, it's just the reference I know. You can add salt to screen the interaction between the object or to make them grow. We will have the opportunity to speak about the electrostatic effect in this system. And this is a huge work made in the Kando group in Strasbourg with CTAB and KBR. But what are people doing? Usually to make micelles, they are using these strongly binding counterions. And these strongly binding counterions have a specific property, and a specific property which is slightly different from what I explained before. What are these counterions? Salicylates, you know this one. Tosylates, there is also chlorobenzoate and so on, a lot of counterions, which are anionic and bulky. These counterions, they are behaving some way like cosurfactants, since I tell you that they are incorporated to the body of the micelles. Okay? But they are not really cosurfactants. They are not really cosurfactants, because of the charge also. Let me illustrate one of the main reasons why people have used this system with strongly binding counterions. The reason is the viscoelasticity. These systems are very viscoelastic and very close to Maxwellian fluid. Two illustrations here. This is the system by Reage and Hoffman, and the system that we have used in Montpellier. And you recognize on G prime as function of the frequency, G double prime as function of the frequency here in the linear scale, a pure Maxwell model. What makes this system so popular and so rich and so interesting is that actually they are in agreement with the theoretical approach from Mike Cates at the end of the 80s, that this approach have shown that there should be a unique relaxation time for these worm-like micelles. Okay? And it is found experimentally, and people are usually happy with that. People are less working on the scaling laws that are also predicted for this system. Scaling laws for the viscoelastic parameters are, for instance, the viscosity of the elastic modulus. And if you look in the literature, these scaling laws are not so well observed. So what is the problem with a strongly binding contrarian? So they are well investigated. They are giving strongly Maxwellian fluid. But they have a first problem. I spoke about curvature at the beginning. With increasing contrarian concentration, there is no change in morphology. This picture is wrong for this system. Okay? This picture is wrong, so it means that, in my opinion, there is a specificity for this contrarian that is not taken into account in the existing theories. And this maybe explains the huge or the very exotic behavior that worm-like micelles are exhibiting, especially if you consider, for instance, this system, again, Reage-Hoffman, the paper in 88 was a very important paper, finally, I find now, where they plot the viscosity as function of this contrarian concentration. And you see a strange result. The viscosity is very low, this is spheres. Then the micelle grow, entangled, goes from maximum, decrease, increase, and decrease. It's complicated. I don't know why it is so. What I know is if you make nonlinear rheology along this curve for different samples, what you get is not a unique behavior. You get what I call these exotic results. For instance, here, in the increase of the viscosity, you see mainly shear thinning. And here, you see something like shear thickening. And sometimes, you find shear thinning and shear thickening. So one unique Maxwellian behavior means that you have micelles, worm-like entangled, but does not mean that the main mechanism is respected, is in agreement with it. So in my opinion, these things have a specificity.
I agree with that, but as far as I remember, not everything in that green box is single exponential. A lot of it is, but some of those, well, I think, two, three, four, five. I think at least one of those regimes is definitely not single exponential.
I have.
This is a detail, actually.
No, I looked to that point. I mean, if I put this box, I looked to that point specifically before preparing the talk. So, there was another plot that disappeared from my presentation where there is a modulus. The modulus for all these things is constant,
yeah.
And I have found a sentence where they are saying that it's Maxwellian, but you. One should
You see the Maxwellian behavior for the small shearing case variable.
Yeah, so the linear viscosity.
Yeah.
But so the non-linear stuff is
different. In non-linear, and this, I mean, for me, there is an inconsistency between these results. A Maxwellian fluid, which is respected, which is in agreement with the theoretical prediction, and the fact that the non-linear rheology is so exotic, so strange.
What's the precision of your statement that it is Maxwellian?
We can discuss about that. What is the precision? I mean, you're right. I don't know. The paper says it's Maxwellian. And if you look the articles we have treated this system, so I know if you take another system, CTAB and acylsilicate, there is this double maximum. And the people have looked, and it is Maxwellian in some. Of course, at high frequency, you have some perturbation of this Maxwellian behavior. That's, I don't know. But what I want to stress is, it's not because the system is Maxwellian that it is a worm-like micelle. It's some worm-like micelle system. But it's not, in all cases, in agreement with the description which is given by a theoretical approach.
Is it the second assembly
regime? Yeah. Otherwise, you should not see any strength in the high viscosity. So I will forget this point for the moment. We will probably come back to it when we're speaking about shear thickening. And I will now tell you about the shear thinning behavior and the plateau and the shear bending. Sorry.
There's no close effectant here, but there must be some close effectant like property of the cataron if you get this change in speed of Williams. I mean, presumably, there is. In some way, like a case that reduces the surface energy associated with curvature.
Will you come back to this point or not?
No.
No. So it's not an answer. Just the same question with some information that I need. Do you mean when you say it's not a real co-surfactant? Do you mean because it's a Z covariant? Of the surfactant, you have the co-surfactant of the contrarian will come to the surface until you get a neutral charge, the same amount of plus and minus,
mm-hmm.
which gives you the transition between sphere and worms.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, once you reach at the surface an electrostatic neutrality, the more contrarian you put.
In this case,
just come as a salt.
Exactly. Something.
So it's not
a really complex. But it is playing the role of a co-surfactant and of salt. But what I find the important point is you never have a reduction of the curvature up to get the lamellar phases.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Don't have the effective charge on a micelle varies.
I don't know it, but probably it's the right question. What is known if you take what I knew from one system we have for one to one, so surfactant to contrarian system, we get typically 90% of the counterions, which are in the body of the micelles, and the rest is in solution playing the role of the counterions. So there is a lot of electrostatic interaction in this case. Even if you, there is an effective charge of the cylinders. So the rheology of worm-like micelles in the most accepted or the nonlinear rheology results that has been found in most of the systems. So forget about this exotic behavior. I have not shown any picture, but I would like to speak about the system we investigated some years ago, which is a very similar system from what that was investigated by Reage and Hoffman. But we here fix two requirements or two important things. We fix the counterion to surfactant concentration ratio. And the reason for that is we want to change the overall concentration here, for instance. And if you do that, you want to have the micelles made from the same proportion of one species with respect to the other. So it's and the second thing, we saturate the solution with salt, with simple salt, to avoid electrostatics. And what we observe, this is a viscosity and this is the elastic modulus. All the systems are strongly Maxwellian. Not this one, of course, but from this viscosity, all the systems are Maxwellian. Here you are losing a little bit from this Maxwellian picture. And we find some scalings in agreement with the prediction of the Gates model. However, to go in the same direction what I've said before, if you change this ratio, you go from 0.5 to 0.6. This agreement here, for example, is less good. So it's good here, and after that, we lose the scaling sooner. This is directly the general flow curve, so the nonlinear rheology we have observed for a system, which is again this one. And this is at 12%, so it is exactly in this region. This is the main picture we observed for a system. So it is very representative of a wide class of system. So this is your shear stress as function of the shear rate. And there is a part here on the left where something seems to be Newtonian. Just there, it's Newtonian. And then we have a discrepancy. We have a deviation with respect to the Newtonian law, which is represented like that. By this dotted line. And above a given shear rate, gamma dot 1, I forgot to write it, we observed in the stationary state of shearing a plateau. All this data have been obtained using the same procedure. We went to a given shear rate, we start from a system at rest, and we impose the shear rate and wait as long as we need to observe and to reach the stationary state. And in the stationary state, we always go back to this plateau. Let me make a comment about the green dots and the blue dots. So as I told, we use transient rheology, which consists to apply a shear rate and to measure the shear stress. And you see in the linear regime, there is nothing to say. Everything seems to be in agreement with a linear response measured separately. When we are coming in the nonlinear regime but below the plateau, we see what is classical for polymers, an overshoot, and the system reach a value, a stress which is constant over time, and you see the amount of shear thinning we have in this case. Up to now, it's very similar to what is known from polymer. Now, the situation of the transient rheology at the stress plateau. So there is three points I would like to emphasize, C, D, and E, which are represented here. So here is the shear stress at the inception of flow goes to a maximum. This is the overshoot, which was similar, which is reminding the polymer situation. And then we reach a constant value of the stress. And it is stable for some times. As you can see here, over 30 seconds or 20 seconds, the stress is not moving. And then it decreases to a value, to the sigma p. Okay? When you go further in this plateau, you see that typically the same picture is valid. But here, the overshoot is larger. There is a starting of an oscillation, and the relaxation is now taking 20 seconds instead of 200 seconds, and faster and faster. This main relaxation is disappearing, and we end up only with strong oscillation of the stress. The question you can ask is, are these oscillations true, or are these oscillations resulting from the mechanical device that is used, a rheometer, to measure the stress? I think these oscillations are true. I think these oscillations are true. They have been measured using different shearing cells. They have been measured, they have been observed on different systems and with different techniques. So this oscillation, which are, I would try to tell you that they are related to the instability, are the true mechanical response of the system. So this picture shows you that there is a plateau, very complicated relaxation of the stress. And I would like to mention this sigma m, the mechanical stress, which apparently, which is this value here of the stress, which shows the maximum. And this reminds, in some respect, the non-monotonic stress flow curve, which is assumed for a system having plateau and exhibiting shear bending. And I was discussing with Peter before the talk, and to remind him, to ask him if these oscillations, because these oscillations are very similar to what is observed in a system which is known as a Johnson-Segelman system from constitutive equation, and it reminds quite a lot this kind of result.
It's clear how you get sigma n from the first graph where there's an intermediate plateau.
Yeah.
How do you actually extract the value of sigma n as the shear rate goes up and things are oscillating?
This is effectively a big problem, since here you see that we are just at the maximum. So here I can still extrapolate, but here I don't have any data for sigma m. Okay, so but you are right. Actually, the two phenomena are merging. The disappearance of the long-time relaxation, which is related to shear bending, and this oscillation. Okay, so but that's the reason why I cannot have data points at high shear rate.
What shear rate is the right-hand side of the oscillator? That particular system, what shear rate was the right-hand side of the stress plateau, where it starts to go up again with shear rate?
What shear rate, sorry?
So you have a plateau, and at the far right-hand end of it, it starts to go up again, supposedly, for a high shear rate branch. Right. Did you access?
Where's the high shear rate branch?
Oh, we never see any high shear rate branch in this system,
right.
At this concentration. This is also, there are other kind of instability or instability in this system that prevent us to see. But let me answer your question in some way. It's what we call the general flow phase diagram, which is obtained by plotting the stress versus the elastic modulus, since everything is Newton, is Maxwellian, versus the normalized shear rate. And you recognize the data I show you, so there is no second branch. And when you increase the concentration, you see a disappearance of this plateau. Okay? When the concentration is decreased, we see a disappearance of this plateau, and we see that we can measure, we can have access to what you refer to as a second branch. However, what is important here, this long-time relaxation exists as long as completely correlated to the plateau. When the plateau disappears, no long-time relaxation, only overshoots.
What happens experimentally when you go for the 12 and 10% samples at shear rate higher than
here?
Gamma dot tau equal 10, for example. Because the other branch you can effectively access to higher normalized.
We cannot make measurement in this range.
What does it mean you cannot?
The sample is expulsed or is leaving the cell.
Even in a quiet cell.
You cannot measure that with a quiet cell. It's too viscoelastic. The modulus is something like 200 Pascal. You could, but you need a special device.
But you can go further than that. You've only got one decade on the plateau. You can go further than one decade.
No. That's true. We cannot. We lose. There is a
concentrated system now, 12%.
Yeah.
No,
just because of the viscosity of the sample.
Well, and because
using
current plate and you have too high of viscoelasticity,
yeah.
You get this double unstable surface, so you get substantial
exactly.
And it flies out.
And it's not clear to me if the shear bending, which is underlying these data, is related to the fact that we cannot measure it at such high shear rate. If there is a connection, probably yes, but I don't know what is this connection. So the point at that time with Grégoire working on this one like micelle system was, for us, it was a strong analogy with a phase transition. And we interpret that in these terms, and since Wormlack micelles are known to exhibit, and we have shown that, nematic phases, we went to this interpretation of isotropic to nematic transition. And let me give you the two arguments we had at that time, and I will show you after that these arguments are not anymore true. The first argument in favor of the IHN transition was if you plot the sigma p, so at the plateau divided by G0. Okay, this is the stress you need to have this plateau divided by the true elasticity of it. If you plot it as function of the concentration, you see that it extrapolates to a concentration which is a miracle, which is the concentration of the isotropic to nematic transition at rest. Okay, this is nematic phase, this is biphasic, this is isotropic. So it means that when you are close to here, so I have no data point here, it's almost no mechanical energy that has been to be input in the system to undergo these changes. Okay, so it was a justification that we found. The second one that was also, we believe in that quite strongly, was about the kinetics at the onset of plateau. You remember, you apply shear rate, the stress grows and decreases slowly, and very reproductively we found in CPCL salicylate a function of that time of that kind, where we get sigma p, some excess in stress, initial excess, and exponential minus t square, and the square was found on several samples and in all experiments and on two samples. And so we interpret this function in terms of, since we are close to the plateau, to the starting of the plateau, in terms of nucleation and growth of this new phase, of this nematic phase, which is strongly in principle aligned. And this is because of its alignment. Because this phase, the new one, is aligned, is less viscous that we are on the in the plateau, that the plateau is the plateau, that the stress is not varying. And the exponent, too, we were quite happy with that, was related to the mechanism, which is a one-dimensional mechanism of nucleation and growth, and the direction of nucleation and growth would be this one, which would be the gradient one. So one dimension, because nucleation and growth in d dimension is the exponents 1 plus d. However, at that time, we make neutron scattering, we make flow by refringence, and the data were not good enough. We could not prove that. We could not prove the coexistence of two phases. The coexistence of the at the plateau, in the plateau region, for neutron bifurcation, for technical reasons, we could not prove this picture.
But are you distinguishing between phases and bands?
I told you that at that time we were interpreting that in terms of isotropic to nematic transition. I completely agree with you. I am mixing the two. Okay.
But you couldn't distinguish macroscopic coexistence of anything.
Exactly. Not in neutron, and not in.
Yeah, but can you come back to the previous transparency? On the 8% or 6% sample, you do have a plateau, and you do have also the high shear rate branch.
Yeah.
So at that time, you did try to do neutron scattering.
Absolutely.
In this region.
We have made neutron scattering from there to there, and
also on the high shear rate.
Absolutely, and we see nothing conclusive.
Nothing conclusive means what? You don't see a very well-aligned.
Exactly, and especially the problem that we had at that time is when you are going through such a curve, you have a discontinuity in stress. You expect a discontinuity in the neutron spectra. You expect that at this shear rate something will happen. And everything was incredibly continuous. We saw a strong anisotropy.
So it would be continuous. No, it would, yeah.
Of course it would be continuous. But how to separate the two? How to separate the two without making too many assumptions?
Okay, Jean-François, that's my point. You don't want to study the two-phase regime. You want to study each one-phase regime separately. If you study a mixture of phases, it's very difficult to separate.
I know.
Okay, so it's why I'm coming back to the 8 and 6% branch. In this case, you can get the pure high shear rate. Okay. In this pure high shear rate, what you mean, you, what you have seen is that it's not well-aligned cylinders. The notion doesn't show well-aligned cylinders.
What do you mean by well-aligned?
Which is something which is anisotropy with no... No,
you mean fully aligned?
Fully aligned.
No, we. It's
can I just make a comment? The last year we've been studying this very system. The X is 10%, not 12%.
Okay.
By NMR, and there's absolutely no evidence of alignment by NMR. Mm. And I can give it, put an order parameter on it of the order of 0.01. There's nothing. There's no order above 0.01%. That's for sure. The CTAP system, we agree completely with birefringence. We see we know the order parameters could be something like 1 there because it's a really nomadic phase. We know how big the splitting is. We look at this system. Mm-hmm. The splitting is at least 100 times smaller. It's in the line. So there's no order there to an order of a percent or two.
And
there
any shear?
On the plate.
On this.
Right across the plate. You've looked right across the plate.
Okay. So we
sounds strange to me because birefringence, even...
You see birefringence?
Yeah, the birefringence and the birefringence, as far as I remember, was strong, but it's difficult to.
The birefringence is exquisitely sensitive in a way.
I don't know the number.
Yeah.
So in a moment, we can put a number on the order parameter. We know how big it is, and it's no bigger than a percent or two. Maybe smaller.
So we should remember that the high shear rate branch is not a branch of well-aligned cylinders.
Absolutely.
Wait.
We're sitting very close to an isothermatic transition
anyway.
And we're pushing it over.
Yes. So that's a 13, 14% or something.
Yeah, 18%.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
So let me continue because I'm coming to the CTAB. So, and so we started because of this difficulties, experimental difficulties, to start with another system, which we investigated and where we showed that there exists a nematic phase at rest. Okay, and it is the simplest system you can imagine. This one surfactant and water, and we used D2O because we wanted to make a combined experiment where we make rheology, neutron and flow birefringence, and we were quite lucky because the stress measured in two different ways correspond completely to the picture of a plateau, which is not seen when the stress is controlled, which is seen when the strain is controlled. And we could see also in birefringence, the measurement was made by Jean-Paul de Krupp, that there is a coexistence in this case, a true coexistence, something which is consistent with my previous picture, something which is strongly birefringent coexisting with something which is less birefringent. And this amount is varying on and along the plateau. Okay, so I put I still find it a nice result, and you could be persuaded that I was dealing with as a topic to nematic transition, but unfortunately, and the reason why I put quotes to IDEO, Callahan have made and his group have made experiments, and I would like to on this system. And I would like to finish my talk with some new results, which in some way are in contradiction with, which are, you will see, in favor or show shear bending, but we will give a more complicated story for this, the non-linear rheology of worm-like micelles. So this is a Fischer-Callahan NMR measurement, and with NMR measurements, what these authors have made on the same system we have investigated, they have tried to answer to this question: does the highly birefringent band correspond to the high shear rate band? One of the questions of your papers. So, which is described. This is a strongly birefringent band. You expect the shear rate is high, the shear rate is small. And this would be the picture we had in mind with Grégoire some years ago. With neutrons, with NMR, they have measured two things: the proportion of nematic phase in the gap, so the same thing as we did with neutron and flow birefringence, and the proportion of nematic phase for this system is in very good agreement with what we found with small-angle neutron scattering, the black dots and the square. You see the agreement is well. I cannot comment on the discrepancy with the flow by F engine because we interpret that, as far as remember, as arising from the different shear cell. I don't know. But you see that the more you shear, the more you go to fill the gap with a strongly bi-referent phase. But what your experiment has shown is that the velocity profiles can be resolved in space. This is the inner cylinder, this is the outer cylinders, and this is the phase which is bi-referent. And the dots that you see is the velocity field. So dots which are increasing slowly means the shear rate is constant. So here they found a constant shear rate in the pneumatic phase, which in this band.
A low shear rate.
Okay?
The constant velocity.
Almost constant velocity.
So it's like plug flow.
This is like plug flow. And this is plug flow here, plug flow there, and everything. But you see that there is a mismatch.
Because the interface between the two phases is in fact shear.
Yeah. Well, but there is a mismatch between this band.
Well, you have to be careful. The velocity profile is an average, it's not a steady state hot problem. I mean, that velocity profile is moving around all the time.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing some sort of an average, which is a peculiar way in which.
But this is the average.
Produces this result, yes.
This is the average.
Yes.
This is not taken at one time.
Well, yeah. And the problem is the way that we measure the velocity is we actually look at the distribution of displacements in a pixel.
Yeah.
We choose the peak, the mode. So it's the most likely velocity, the one that occurs most often in that pixel. But in fact, the velocity is changing. So
okay.
You really have to look more deeply. But the picture is correct.
Okay. I did not want to make an incorrect statement. And I have read your paper the last week.
I'll send
and Okay. So this was the first thing which was quite weird in this system, that the fact that the band could be not necessarily of high shear rate. And I would like to conclude with a recent result obtained in MESS, this is a part of the work, of the PhD work of Sandra Lerouge. And they have investigated one system, which is not with counter ions, which is a normal salt, which is a strange salt, I don't know why, but it's a good system in biofringence, and which this system, CTAB and ANO3, has a specificity is it has the same rheology, exactly the same rheology as the one I tell you before. So the same overshoot, the same transient, the same, everything the same, more or less. And what they have shown is, so let me make a comment. The numbers are different,
yeah.
But the experiment gives the same. What they have shown with birefringent first, this is a gap that they see from above. They have shown that there is the appearance of a band, okay? And if they measured with a very sophisticated technique the flow birefringent and extension angle where the cross is, they can show that there is something which reminds you the stress, you know? Overshoot, long time relaxation and constant. Okay? And the same here, where here you have something maybe more complicated. So they have shown that there is this kind of exponentials, this long-term relaxation, which are related to the stress. And that these two kinetics seen in flow by referent in stress are identical, or the resulting from the same mechanism, which is related to the appearance of the band. However, they have shown something very, very still stranger, and which goes against the presentation, the first part of my talk. So this is, again, transient birefringence. This is a small and tiny band which appears just there. And they have scanned this plot. And you see here the transmitted light by the cell, by the sample. You also see the outer cylinders, the inner cylinders. And you see this decrease here represents this band. Okay, and they have waited long enough in time where the stress is not changing, where nothing is changing, and what they see in this experiment for this system, that this band, which appears, which is shear banding, split into a lot of smaller bands. And these bands typically here, which are represented on this with these red areas, these bands have the size of 100 micrometers. So if you think it's exactly the contrary of what is thought usually. Usually, when you have shear bending, what is said is bends appears everywhere, and because of the curvature of quetzal, they are all migrating where the stress is. This is a picture that people have usually. Here, for a reason which is not known to me, this is the contrary. So it explodes in a multi-banded structure.
Are these bends or are these just vortices that are swirling around and you see actually?
What do you mean, vortices?
I mean, if something is swirling around with a higher positive or negative velocity rather than constant bends where distance is well separated.
If you look carefully, it's like striation. The system seems to be striated, and you see bands of stronger alignment going through the flow. And in a, I don't want to use a chaotic way because it's I don't know if it's chaotic or not, but in a non-stationary way, okay. So they are moving, but you see these bands, and this is the way to represent them in the most simplest way. So I'm done with this presentation on the shear thinning of worm-like micelles. I think that it's recognized that in the entangled state, worm-like micelles are Maxwellian fluid, most of them, most of them. What is clear, most of the systems that has been investigated are exhibiting a stress plateau. This is something which is, and this stress plateau is related to the long-time relaxation. And this long-time relaxation, as far as it has been investigated with flow birefringence, NMR, and this sophisticated technique, shows that there is shear bending. The system adopt a new structure of bands of different alignments. And the isotropic to pneumatic transition is maybe less appropriate. And the description, which has been made recently on the theoretical basis of mechanical instability, seems to me now a much plausible assumption. What I think are the possible things to do in the future, what I would be interested if somebody can propose me, how to determine this non-monotonic constitutive equation, which is assumed to be experimentally, I mean, underlying the stress plateau. If you have ideas, or if you want to, I can propose you one, but I'm not sure it works. And what I think what is very important is to investigate the spatial and temporal quantities which are involved in this system. So to look at the micrometer length scales and to make in some sense microrheology in this system, to know what is the flow field and stop saying, and what is the alignment if it's possible at a local scale, and to investigate the interfaces and so on. So I thank you for your attention.
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused. You showed us two different systems, the CTAP system and the CPCL system.
Yeah.
And it seems that they have differences, experimental differences, which are quite important, because from what I understand, the CTAP system effectively shows a phase, let's say, where you have a strongly aligned cylinders, when the CPCL system doesn't show that. Even both, they have a plateau in the stress.
This is true, yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean.
So, do we have to remember that they belong to the same class of problems, or do we have to remember that, in fact, they are competitive in our system, even so, the stress shear rate curve looks the same? They are different.
I would have said the first one.
Okay, good. So I have
good reason
to be confused.
No, I'm sorry if my message is confusing. Both systems are have bands.
Yes.
It's
a bit complicated because you have the trouble is. Since you're doing experiments, unfortunately, you have to use a coet, and the stress is not uniform in a coet flow. And because of that, because you have a higher stress near the inner wall, you could have a system where you had a stress-induced transition to a much more viscous state. You could have it, and if you're in the region of stress that
is in this kind of coexistence region, you're going to have that in all, regardless of what the velocity profile is doing. And so the thing about the velocity profile and an interface between phases, if the phase transition is caused by stress rather than flow in the couette, you have to keep those things separate in your mind because the stress is not uniform. Now, it, obviously, it's inevitable in the experiments that that's how it is, but it does mean there are two separate things which are going on potentially, which are a stress-induced pneumatic,
yes,
and a shear instability leaving the banding. And they could be happening in the same sample in different places, which is sort
what
of
what you mean. One thing that's clear is that the birefringent bend is always next to the wall of the CTEP system. It never occurs out in the cell by itself.
No.
So it's sort of very much consistent with what Mike is saying there. Whereas the...
Well, if it's a shear induced transition, you would get the birefringent bend near the wall.
Well, that's true. Because that's where the shear bend mostly is. That's where it's generating the pneumatic phase. That's where it's coming from. That's the effect you would use. But the velocity profile is jumping all over the place.
Is what is jumping?
I mean, the shear band is moving around in that CTAP system. It's migrating rapidly back and forward. But you have this pneumatic phase which is produced near the wall, it gradually dies off as you get away from the wall, and the birefringence agrees, the NMR agrees, and that's sort of consistent with the fact that it could be produced by stress and has nothing whatever to do with the constitutive instability. Could be. On the other hand, as Peter says, it could be generated by the high shear band. I mean, that's the other way, in which case you'd expect to see that near the wall as well. But I think that the idea of a constitutive instability.
Do you think that the analogy in the flow curves between one system and the other would be, in this case, fully fortuitous?
No, I agree with you. I think it's the same. I think it's underlying constitutive instability in both of them, whereas in the CTAP system, you also get this induced.
Exactly. I would say it's.
It's
going
on. Yeah.
It's
one system, you have one of them, and the other, you seem to have both.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but why don't you see the signature of that in the stress shear rate curve? Why don't you see the signature that in one case you have only one phenomenon, when in the other case you have both? Or would we be the signature of that in the sigma gamma dot curve?
Because what I did not say is that as far as I remember. These two curves, one was made with couette and the other was made with cone and plate. So and the agreement is astonishingly good. So I think the strain control was made with couette and the other with cone and plate. So
well, what's learned for a stress-induced nucleation close to the wall? It could just be a surface effect.
The stress is higher at the wall.
Well, that's okay, but what about just something induced by the wall?
Because it's about a centimeter thick, that wall, you know, not a centimeter, but it's thick, it's not as well.
But then on.
It doesn't appear in a... It's not really kinetic control. He has a reproducible steady state. So it's not, you're not so much worried about whether it nucleates faster at the wall. It's just
what's the state of the system before you reach the plateau? Is it pneumatic or non-pneumatic state?
Before the plateau?
Yes.
The neutron
shows birefringence just in the plateau.
Yeah. We see the band just in the plateau. Before you see slight birefringence because all this, but it's flow birefringence which is very small.
But I mean, that's the difference
between
the top
picture. But there is a transition into a pneumatic state.
There is a transition? No.
In CTAB.
Yeah, so in your conclusion, it seemed as if you meant no pneumatic state ever. But here you do mean that.
There is a shear-induced transition into a pneumatic state. But strangely enough, the pneumatic state seems to have the higher and not the lower. That's what
we
are surprised about.
Which sounds... Because if
now
you...
The question is, what's the other phase?
That isn't intrinsically strange.
Oh.
Pneumatic phases are generally very viscous. I don't know where...
No.
Usually the viscosity is a decade lower from the closest isotropic state.
Yeah, so can you repeat that?
The viscosity, I mean, I've seen that in Oh, sorry. No. Where is it? So if you, for instance, check in the micelles, the viscosity as a function of the concentration,
yeah,
and you have the biphasic, you have something usually which is like that,
yes,
and a bit, well, maybe exaggerate for you know, it's usually lower, and lower by factor 10.
Yeah.
So to imagine that it is more viscous is something which is very weird.
What's the influence on the mimetic state on the length of the worms? I mean, are these things going to affected association recombination reactions on the line? Surely it's going to be quite different kinetics there.
It is. I mean, all I can say. I mean, that's the result there is certainly interesting. It's not obvious to me that that's how it should be, but if that's how it is, that's how it is.
I mean, it's
that's zero.
Sure.
That's his measurement.
That's my measurement. And there. I mean, I remember to have seen this plot. I hope I'm not wrong, but in the Doy Edwards book, there are the viscosities as function of the concentration, and the viscosity of the nematic phase at the end of the book is, as far as I remember, lower.
Yeah, but
that's true. I would be very, very cautious about all these statements, because even if you take an aligned nematic phase,
it's not aligned.
If you include some defect,
exactly,
you increase the
viscosity. You will see a viscosity that really just goes up, which has nothing to do with the intrinsic viscosity of the nematic.
This is true.
I don't know whether or not the viscosity of the nematic phase is above or below the isotropic phase.
I think even with defects, if you don't change the length of the objects, the viscosity will always be lower than in the isotropic phase.
I don't know.
I think it is.
Well, you take polymers. Nematic polymers have a higher viscosity.
Than the isotropic phase?
Yes. Some of them do.
I
think
that depends on how you orient.
Yeah.
If you have stiff rods and inner rods and you're shifting,
yes,
more or less along the flow direction, then you have the lower viscosity. However, if you have these wobbly things, and you mentioned they are wobbling, and then they get hooked and the viscosity may get up, then they're more behaving like a synaptic which is oriented in the wrong direction.
Jean-François, does one know if this is independent of how the surface was created, or it has something to do with the surface or not?
My answer to that is that since this is made in stainless steel, the quartz, in neutron it is made with quartz, glass or quartz, and with quartz with rheology it's made with titanium. Maybe there is some chance that I don't think it's related to. From the previous effect and investigated. <yeah.
laughs> What is very impressive is the fact that you get more or less the same shear stress against shear rate behavior. Whatever you are using, different cells, you are using different stress control, strain control. In one case, you have a plateau, in the other, you have a jump from one branch to the other. This means to me that this doesn't depend, the position of the branch and the fact that you have a plateau doesn't depend on details like whether or not you have a curved quartz cell or whether or not you have a
stainless steel?
Yeah,
whatever.
It's not this kind of detail which are important to explain the existence of the two branches and the fact that you go from one to the other. Mm-hmm. So there is something which is very robust in the data which compares that, which seems in the CTAP system to be related to the isotropic nematic transition, from what I understand. Now, coming back to the other system, does the plateau region is effectively the same whether you use a stress control rheometer or strain control rheometer? Do we have the same kind of nice feature or not?
The other system.
In the other system, the CPCL system.
Yeah. I have to remember, but I would say it's. I mean, we would have noticed something if. I mean, it has been done a certain number of times. So, I remember the paper with McLuffy in '95, where there was the first picture of the band. I think they also made some shear rate experiment in Montpellier, and it was in agreement. It was or other systems. So I guess this is also not the point.
But what about this feature of having two blood flows with a small shear band? Does that also apply to CTAB or?
There was the CTEP.
The CTEP was, yeah.
So a related question. If you just look at the proportion of one phase versus the other, which you've measured by more than one technique, you could have checked whether it obeyed a kind of a lever rule.
I think it's not working.
It doesn't.
Yeah, it's not working, the level, and of course, in the system which are less concentrated, this CP SAR and so on, it's not working at all. So because these bands are very thin and usually...
Well, you mean by not working, you mean it's not proportional?
Yeah, it's not proportional to...
I mean, the velocity profile, I think, it has to have no choice, but it's
a very naive question from a theorist to an experimentalist is birefringence. Remember, like Perkins and Schubert, like 5 or 6 years ago, they looked in with sort of fluorescently labeled DNA, put that into flow, and then they saw on the one end they had with macroscopic measurements, birefringence to see the flow pattern and the elongation of the molecules. Then they showed that if you don't look at an sort of ensemble time, whatever average, but if you really look at the individual molecules, it's very different. You really had to understand that you had to look at the individual molecules. Now, could you take things like, let's say, fluorescently labeled DNA and mix them into these systems and look at them with video microscopy, how they sort of just flow by and how they look in the different regimes of your flow bands. You have a microscopic probe of what's really going on. Yeah, well, the reason why I'm not just saying
it's the theorist who answered the question.
No, I don't want to fluorescence.
That's good because.
I mean, if you take the whole chain, it also tells you that the thing is from ripped apart, made straight by
exactly.
The flow pattern. So that's why I don't want.
And what was the, I have not understood one part of the question. What was the observation of the birefringence? It was strongly birefringent too or not?
Yeah, I don't remember the details, but there seemed to be a standard way of interpreting microscopic flow patterns. And what they showed was that it was pretty wrong. That you, so with the birefringence, you got results which were, I don't know, either over or under.
The birefringence here, I mean, these bands is overlighted. There's a lot of lights. So does it mean that there are not, I mean, one should maybe reduce the experiment and look in details if there is not, after your work, sub-band and so on. But to answer your question, birefringence, as far as I've understood, is a technique which is measuring the refractive index tensor of a fluid underflow or not underflow. But so it gives you an orientation and the amount of anisotropy in the system. Okay, so it's of course average over at least the length scale of the light, which is used to make the measurement. So it's the alignment angle, for instance, chi is the angle of the average alignment of micelles of molecules over a space which is already a mesoscopic, so to speak. Okay. So of course it has nothing to do with your description where you can see with DNA which are labeled where you can see that they are strongly aligned and relaxed and aligned and relaxed or make things like that. So this is an average an experiment which averages orientation, I would say.
Could you give me that stick, please?
So no. The answer is totally correct. There's nothing wrong with slope, but it's in time average. And if you have a particle which is making an equal
for instance,
rotation, then you see no orientation.
Exactly.
If it's staying and making slower and faster rotation, then on average you have a longer residence time, which tells the dielectric tensor has a preferential direction, and that's what's seen in that birefringence. The individual molecule may do wild things which you just do not see. It's wrong if you would conclude that the molecule are doing what the average orientation is doing.
Exactly.
That would be wrong.
Yeah.
But if one knows what the technique is, then one would conclude.
Are there any striking differences between CTAP and CPCL? Like, for instance, do the isotropic pneumatic concentrations differ dramatically?
Yes.
Or are they, was one of them known to be much stiffer than the other, which would cause the ion transitions?
So my question is, pneumatic phase or Wernicke micelles occurs always in the same concentration range. For CTAB is 20%, for CPCL is 30% or 35%. But okay, between 20 and 34 micelles is almost no different because it's already a very concentrated system. It's not in a concentration which is 5% or like DNA, like some stiffer. So Wernicke micelles in terms of persistent length extrapolated to isotropic to pneumatic transition are very similar.
But the big difference
first,
here is this system is sitting right next to the ion transition. It's only a couple of degrees away in temperature from the isotropic pneumatic transition. Whereas the other system is miles away.
So
exactly.
So we're not comparing like with like here. I mean, this is
so this one, the ion transition, you said, was at 16 or something?
80, well, it's, it depends whether it's D to L.
It's
yeah.
Low end of what
it's around 20%.
These 20%. Have, okay, these experiments have a fairly high concentration.
Yeah.
So
yes.
This is they are much nearer it than the other one.
Yes, they're sitting.
But
the,
just what
the
is
isotropic side of the transition, and if you want to measure the temperature, it's about 2 degrees.
What happens if you started in the two-phase region? What do you find?
Well, I haven't tried that.
But that suggests that if you just tried the experiment with CPCL at a higher concentration, so you purposely started near the ion transition.
Exactly, you get still plateau or plateau which are slightly increasing. You get the same thing. Now, what is very astonishing is the rheological behavior of the two systems. If you take one close to a transition and one far away, when exhibiting a plateau, the rheology is the same. You get a plateau, which might be a little bit inclined if you look carefully, or even if you don't look carefully, but you always have this relaxation of the stress. The stress goes to something and relax over a time, which has nothing to do with the intrinsic relaxation time of the system. So there is some rearrangement at this scale at the microscopic scale, which is shear bending, and which might have the expression of a of this new pneumatic phase.
Are there any experiments on elongation of flow? I'm going back to Ralph's question about the rotation of the molecule.
We have tried elongational flow. If you try something very viscoelastic with the apparatus available.
What is that? Is the suction
method? Yeah, yeah. It's these two nozzles and. It's only blurks, blurks, blurks. So you have to reduce the concentration by a factor 10.
And then
you are out of this and already it's strongly aligned. It's huge. But I mean, this is probably something different.
Yeah.